Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to industry leaders and innovators sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. This week I am joined by Matt Walls. Matt, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. You are the CEO of Trilbee, but look, I guess in your own words, correct me if I have butchered your name, give us a quick overview of Trilbee and what the company does, just to kick us off.
Thanks, James. And first of all, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. You said the name well. It's awesome. Walls. And yeah, CEO of Trilbee. Been on board here just about 3 years. Mm-hmm. Coming up on my 3rd year anniversary next month.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think one of the things that I've realized, and it was a bit of ignorance from my end, is that Trilbee is actually a Swedish company, you mentioned to myself, but of course you're based over in the States. So for those who perhaps are like me and were a little bit ignorant, I guess, what is it that Trilbee does, if you were to try and sum that up in a nutshell?
Sure. I mean, Trilbee helps our customers take global control of their patient recruitment for clinical trials. Mm-hmm. So if you follow clinical development, one of the number one blockers these days is finding enough patients to participate. We have a platform and services offering that helps alleviate that for our customers and help them enroll their studies and get into clinical data collection.
Amazing. Okay, well, I'm sure we will jump into that, but I guess first to maybe take you back on a bit of a journey, that you've been with the company a few years, as you mentioned, but how did you first even fall into this space? Often I say fall because that's typically the story that I hear, but what's your background, Matt?
Yeah, my background's in software engineering, oddly enough. And so I was sort of fell into life sciences. I was working for Microsoft and they were working on a joint project with a very large pharmaceutical company.
Right.
And I was part of the team that went on site with the pharma company to help implement this. And as part of that, started to learn a little bit about clinical development. Mm-hmm. They were trying to, at the time, build, I guess, a web-based system that connected research sites and CROs and pharma together to exchange clinical documents, study startup packages and other documents related to clinical trial conduct.
Gotcha.
And so that's how I learned about clinical development. I left Microsoft and was working with another gentleman from Microsoft. We were at a company called Data Labs at the time.
Yeah.
And they were in clinical development. They had an EDC product. And we were sitting there signing the release for a version of the software. And Data Labs was based on the West Coast. We were on the East Coast. And there was all this faxing of documentation going back and forth. We'd have to sign, fax it back to them. They'd sign, fax it back to us. And we asked the question,
when was this, Matt?
This is not that long ago, 2005.
Wow.
Yeah. So we asked the question, why is all the faxing taking place? Why do we have to do it this way? Can't we just sign online?
Yeah.
And the answer from the quality team at the Times was only Documentum can do that in these big expensive systems.
Right.
So it was like, that's a great idea for a business model. Let's come up with a less expensive alternative to Documentum at the time. And myself and that other gentleman who I was with at Microsoft and then with at Data Labs, we ended up coming back together sometime later and founding a company called NextDocs in 2006.
Yeah.
And NextDocs built a regulatory document management suite for biopharmaceutical companies to solve just that problem. Mm-hmm. It also had a lead candidate product, which we called ETMF, which solved the problem that Microsoft and that large pharma were working on. So it was kind of an interesting triangulation there of getting experience into clinical development and then starting a company to kind of solve that problem.
Wow. Okay. And then at what point did the Trilbee gig come into this? Were you, after kind of those early successes, were you poached away? Was it friends? Was it networking? Was it someone you met at a conference? How did the interaction with Trilbee come along?
Yeah. It's a really interesting story. So we had sold NextDocs, and I was working for the company that acquired it, a private equity firm.
Yeah.
And I've been there about 5 years, felt it was, you know, the right time to look for something else. And about that time, the pandemic had just hit. So everything was remote. And I started doing interview searches for kind of what I wanted to do next. And I was evaluating, do we start something else or do I take a job somewhere?
Yeah.
And I spent 3 months looking for a job. And after a lot of interviews and some offers, picked one I was going to go join and was actually at the contract stage. So my lawyer was literally reviewing the contract to join this company. It's an AI-based company. When I got a call, and it was a search firm, and they said, hey, we're searching for a new CEO for this company, Swedish-based company, bringing, you know, kind of gone into Europe, now coming into the US, looking for a new product-oriented CEO. Do you know anybody?
Yeah.
And I said, you're terrible. Your timing's terrible because I just spent 3 months on my own search and I'm at the end of that. But tell me a little bit about the company. I'll see if I know anyone.
Mm.
And as they began to describe Trilbee, you know, my heart just lit up. I remember it was in the car going down to North Carolina with my family when I took that call. And it just felt right on so many levels, right size company, right mission, trying to solve a really important problem. And I just got excited and I said, hey, if this was a Friday, I said, if you can get me on the phone with the chairman by Monday and we hit it off, I'll delay this other job I'm supposed to start and you know, see if we can make something happen. And so ended up really getting along with the chairman on that Monday. And, you know, I guess 4 months later had the job.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. So Trilbee then, what was it about the mission that kind of, I guess, look, you're driving along with your family on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
It must have been something that really hit you to be like, you know, you've got a recruiter on the end of the phone.
Yeah.
And you're like, there must have been something. So what is it about that mission? Could you expand on that mission just so that we've, and the audience have kind of got an overview of that mission?
Yeah. You know, so you ever have one of those things where you get really excited in the moment, but you don't realize until hindsight why?
Way
it
too
was kind of like that. Yeah. So when I was starting NextDocs, we were a year into founding that company. And my 6-year-old daughter at the time was diagnosed with rhabdomyosarcoma, which is a really aggressive form of childhood cancer.
Wow.
And the doctors were telling us she had a 10% chance. Odds were 10% that she would survive.
Wow.
And it was just a really difficult time for the family. But we're very fortunate because we live 20 minutes from Children's Hospital Philadelphia, which in the U.S. is one of the best pediatric oncology hospitals.
Mm.
So we had great access to research right up the street, and got her involved in clinical trials right away. She did a few procedural and I think one interventional trial. And today my daughter's fine. She's 22. She's in her senior year of college.
I'm so glad
she's been in remission.
A good news story on that. I think you would have seen my face drop.
Yeah. If anybody who has kids knows how helpless that can feel when they're sick. So we had this great outcome. She's been cancer-free since 2008, but my wife and I really credit the clinical trial for saving her life. And so Trilbee, right? Our vision at Trilbee is to increase awareness of clinical research to people who might not otherwise find out about it.
Yeah.
And I think about my story and my daughter, and what if we lived somewhere else in this country or somewhere else in another country where we didn't have Children's Hospital of Philadelphia 20 minutes down the road? Would we have known about the trial and would we have had the same outcome? And so I think that's probably why my heart lit up. I mean, I didn't think all that in the moment in that car with my family, but looking back, I think there's a lot of personal passion there.
Oh, I can. Yeah. I mean, just hearing you say that back, I can absolutely imagine that when you had the chance to take it all in. So that was, what was the year that you actually joined Trilbee then? Was it
November 2020?
2020. Okay. So quite a crazy time for the industry. Juggling kind of an offer and then deciding to actually go for a new offer with Trilbee, what with everything that was going on. What did the early days look like for you then as the new CEO at that time where the whole world was going crazy?
Well, the first thing that was really weird was trying to step in as a new CEO and the company's entirely remote, right? Nobody was working out of any office at that point in time.
Yeah.
And you know, whenever you join a company at that level or any level where there's direct reports and stuff, it's like a body transplant, right? The body can reject whatever you're transplanting in. And so onboarding is really, really critical.
Mm.
So I thought a lot about how to onboard well in a virtual world. And I credit that, you know, kind of thinking with being able to onboard well into the company. But that was my main concern at the time, was just onboarding well, getting in there, getting a sense for the business, but also forming and building relationships with these people over a virtual format.
And how, I guess, yeah, how did you find that as kind of the new CEO onboarding, I guess, yourself as a virtual company? And as far as I'm aware, it's a global company. So how did you juggle that? I mean, how much time were you spending on, I guess, conferences like this and Zoom and Teams? And it must have been, just talk us through that to give us an overview.
Yeah, it was a lot. You know, a few things I think that we did early on that have been part of our success. We looked at culture and relationship building as something we needed to program for the organization. So that people had constant connection points with one another besides just their day job. And so, like every week at Trialbee, I get randomly paired with somebody else in the company. We do this thing called Fika time, and we have to connect and have some coffee and just chit chat about non-work related stuff for, you know, a half hour or so. So that promotes just random pairing of people every week. Every week, everybody on the company gets on a stand up for 30 minutes. We, you know, I'll open it with some kind of update on the business, and then we'll do a spotlight of some work that some employees doing somewhere in the organization. We call that our spotlight session.
Yeah.
We do quarterly virtual meetings on how the business is performing. And then once a year, we all get together and fly to Malmo, Sweden. And so these type of things, I think, helped really form the company around building relationships from the early start. And I think that was a, you know, an idea that I had reading through this book called The First 90 Days. Anybody who's joining any new role where you have direct reports, I highly encourage reading The First 90 Days. It's all about onboarding well and how to onboard successfully. And reading through that book, that kind of gave a lot of the ideas behind some of the programming we have behind our culture today.
Nice. So I guess from there, I guess it must have been a bit of a whirlwind start with COVID and everything else. But we're now, I guess, a good few years on. If you were to kind of now explain Trialbee from what you were perhaps expecting to what it is now, how would you describe it? So I think probably my confusion when I first looked up Trialbee, I was like, is it just another patient recruitment business? Is it something else? You know, if you to explain it to, you know, someone like myself, 6-year-old education level,
sure.
What would it be? I guess, look, a lot of our audience, they're clinical research folk, but is it just kind of digital marketing? Is it, you know, what it's, because I get the sense there's a bit more to it. So be interesting to know kind of how you describe it, so that, yeah, people could look it up and take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, there's three pieces to Trialbee. The first piece and kind of the centerpiece that we anchor the business around is a core piece of technology we call Trialbee Honey.
Right.
It's a SaaS platform. It's a workflow platform for everything a patient goes through to be pre-qualified for a study and walked into a site, so to speak. And it has a lot of analytics so that you can kind of see how global recruitment is going. So that's the corner piece. And then we have this amazing delivery team. These are people with an average of 10 years experience running global patient recruitment projects. They understand the different regulatory complexities that exist in patient recruitment across different countries. They know how to do all the translations and get the ethics approvals through so that a project can launch or a campaign can launch in different countries.
Yeah.
So that's our global delivery. Inside of delivery, we also have a digital marketing team. That team uses a lot of real world data to define models for how we're going to do outreach. So we do digital marketing ourselves. So that's the services piece, and that wraps around that platform. And then the third piece is our partnerships. We call them omnichannel partnerships. And so what we do when we look at a protocol that we're going to recruit for is we define all the ways of all the pathways that patient may take to learning about their disease.
Right.
And then our aim is to make sure in those different pathways, they learn about the opportunity of this clinical research. So one pathway is online searching or online social groups. And we, you know, that's traditional digital marketing that we do. Yeah. But our partnerships cover other pathways. So for example, we were recently working on a protocol that required a mom to be within 2 months of giving birth. Likely not searching online at that point in time. There's other pathways that mom may take. And so we partnered with an organization, the What to Expect When You're Expecting. They have an app and they have an online presence and they have social. And so, you know, partnering with them as a partner to also drive up awareness. We partner with pharmacy groups. We partner with online disease communities. We partner with patient advocacy groups. So we define, I think we have, I don't know what the number is. We're approaching 70 partners. And these are companies that aren't necessarily doing patient recruitment, but they're going to be in that patient's pathway. And it's an opportunity to let a patient know. And then if the patient wants to learn more, then they come into our Honey platform. And so those are kind of the three pieces we do, you know, the technology, the global delivery, and the omni-channel partnerships.
Interesting. And look, that last piece, I mean, it seems very simple. I'm guessing that probably not everyone is always doing the simple things. How much do you think that actually impacts that patient recruitment, engagement, and pathway, if you like? Because as you say, if you're not working in the world of clinical research, until kind of COVID-19 hit, a lot of people were a little bit, just didn't know what it was. So how much do you think that drives up kind of activity? And have you noticed that? Have you got any, metrics on that since kind of adding, this kind of three pillar system that it sounds like, since you've joined the business?
Yeah, from an impact perspective, I think, so a couple of things set the stage for what Trilby does. I do believe the pandemic made the world much more aware of the importance of clinical research, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody was participating in a treatment for COVID that wasn't necessarily approved, but was receiving, temporary approval status.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone was aware of the clinical trials to get there. I think the pandemic also made people much more online savvy in terms of their work, right? So mm-hmm. different populations are now online more than ever. And I think from a statistic perspective, if you look at a clinical trial today, and again, I can't say this data is authoritative, but from our view, 50 to 60% of patients are going to come from your research sites. The physician is getting them referred, or the physician has them in the care practice and is offering them the research. So what you're doing with recruitment is you're trying to find the other half, basically. And traditionally, a lot of that other half would come from a lot of it from Facebook. Facebook was generally about half of that other half, at least. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot more patients learning through different channels coming in today. I don't have an exact statistic on it, but I can tell you that in today's world, there's a lot more happening online, especially coming out of the pandemic, around diseases, around treatment options. And so I think it's a good opportunity for us to embed in these different patient pathways.
Sure. Why do you think it is that there's more people coming from, outside of that Facebook platform? I know that there was sort of big talks around the iOS changes and sign-ins and things like that. Is that partly to do with it, or is it just that, you've got to expand, otherwise you're going to get left behind?
Well, yeah. I think Facebook still contributes a lot. But I also think it wasn't getting us there before, right? These trials were late, they were delayed, they weren't finding the patients on time. Mm. So I don't know necessarily that where the patients are coming in has shifted. But what I can say is that by opening up more channels to find patients and make them aware, you have better odds of enrolling the study on time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's more having more at-bats, we would say in the US, more chances to get in front of a patient and make them aware than just betting on one platform.
I see.
Which wasn't necessarily getting it there before.
Gotcha. Well, now moving forward, in terms of things, how they're going now, if you were to give us a snapshot at present. So when you joined, again, don't need exact numbers. If you've got them, I'll be impressed. But what was the headcount like then? How many countries were you operational in? and how does it look like right now?
Oh, really good question. Boy, I don't have all the stats. I know that from a headcount perspective, we're about three times the size of what we were 3 years ago. From a growth in study perspective, I think at that time, our studies were generally in one or two countries, different countries. And our model was always scalable. We just weren't in a lot of countries, but we always had a scalable model. So I think each of our studies maybe was a handful of countries. Today, I would say a quarter or more of our studies are in the high teens of countries.
Wow.
You know, 200, 300, sometimes almost 400 research sites participating. So I don't know that our capabilities to do more countries change, but the body of work that we're working on and the coverage that we have in terms of what we're recruiting for has grown significantly over the last 3 years.
Wow. Sounds fairly impressive. Has there been any particular standout moment for yourself, or I guess, you know, biggest kind of win, as it may be, for the company, whether that's been taking on a particular client or a particular result where you've, you know, it's had a personal impact? I guess, look, you spoke earlier about the kind of personal mission. Has there been anything like that that you would could pinpoint?
I don't think so. You know, if I look at our trajectory over the last 3 years, it's been a fairly steady pace. And I think it's been just consistently focusing on fundamentals. I mean, the biggest thing that stands out to me is how much we built our culture and hired around our culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's had the biggest impact on the company, if you ask me. So that's not like we signed the biggest contract or we got the biggest study, but bringing in the level of talent that we're able to attract into the company, I think has been the number one ingredient to our success. But outside of that, it's just been a lot of consistent work.
And how do you go about that? Because I guess in my game as a, you know, running a recruitment business, I know that that can be a nightmare in itself. Probably 90% of the founders or CEOs I speak to tell me that finding people with the right level of qualifications and experience is tough enough. And then when you consider you want to get people that are going to fit with the existing team or gel with the existing team, it is just sometimes nigh on impossible. How do you feel that you've managed to do that and still ramp at the rate that you have? Because, you know, to almost triple your headcount in 3 years, that's pretty impressive if you're also kind of listing one of the biggest achievements as having that amazing culture. Because normally it's very difficult for those two to go hand in hand. So, yeah, I'm just interested how you managed to go about that with kind of internal policies. Like you mentioned a couple of things kind of earlier with, you know, get-togethers, et cetera. But is there, anything else outside of that? Or?
Well, I mean, I think the people who come in and are part of building the culture that we have, they become protective of it. Right. And so they become gatekeepers. And I remember the last November, about a year ago, we were all together in Malmo. And one of the things I said to the team was, hey, it's up to you. Right. Because I'm obviously not screening every candidate that comes in the door. and so the team becomes somewhat protective of that culture and we embed it into our interviews. And so every interview with every person at Trilby has an assessment piece where they're looking at, is this candidate a good cultural fit? Do they have the values of humble and kind and curious and fun?
Yeah.
Because those are important values to the business. And that's kind of what we hire around, aside from just assessing the skill sets. And so I think the organization starts to protect it itself if you do a good job focusing on it.
No, I think sometimes that sort of thing is useful. And if I encourage clients to use like scorecards and things like that so that everyone is assessed fairly, and it's, you know, it's not just a case of one hiring manager's like, oh, I like this type of person, and another one's like this. Otherwise, as a whole, you just end up with lots of different silo groups. So it sounds like you've got something like that in place. I appreciate that.
We do.
Your day to day, but it sounds like that's in place there.
Yeah, it is. And I think the other thing too is if we bring in someone who's going to have direct reports, we usually have the team get involved at some level in the interview too. I know when I personally hire on my leadership team, try to get all the other leaders involved in hiring that position so that they know who their peer is going to be.
Yeah.
So you try to, you know, hiring is tough, right? You never really know, but you can try to limit the negative outcomes by spending more time during the hiring process and involving more people. You know, sometimes that means we have a more drawn out interview process, which I think if you want to ding us on something, that's something we could definitely be dinged on. But as a result, we generally make good hire decisions for the most part.
Amazing. Look, certainly not trying to ding you on anything. it almost feels like I am now, because I was thinking that we've talked about some of the successes and what's been going well. It sounds like there's a lot, but I think, you know, it'd be crazy to think that it's all plain sailing, because it never is, no matter what the business is, right? So if you were to kind of think back over, you know, any of the challenging points, clearly perhaps one of them was when you joined and it was all remote, but what are the biggest challenges that you've maybe faced, and how have you and the wider team, because it's not just yourself, is it? You know, how have the company overcome any particular challenges that you faced in the 3 years you've been there?
You know, it's funny. When I was going to college, there used to be a joke that the professors would say that college would be great if it wasn't for the students, you know. And sometimes I apply that joke and I say, you know, work would be great if it wasn't for all the humans running around, because I think we're the ones that create the challenges ultimately. And so I remember, like, early on when we first started hiring, you know, part of the job was to bring Trilby's model into the US market.
Yeah.
And so we were hiring more in the US. And then this fear kind of struck him. Oh, we got a new US CEO. He's doing all this hiring in the US. Are we becoming a US company? And is this really where I want to work now? And so we create sometimes the challenges that we have to work through.
Yeah.
And I think there's little things like that have happened. I can't think of a major challenge. You know, maintaining culture, I think, is tough as you grow. When you're a small person, when you're a small team, everybody knows each other and it's a good tight bond. And so it's easy to have a good culture. As you grow and you delegate out management at multiple layers, I think it becomes harder to scale that. And by nature, the business becomes more siloed in its work. And so you don't have that same collaboration. And so the trick becomes, how do we keep the culture going? How do we keep the collaboration going despite the growth, or in spite of the growth? And so I think that's probably the biggest challenge. You know, if there's something that keeps me up at night, it's, the two things would keep me up at night. One is, can we maintain our culture as we grow and scale the business and not lose that? Because we do believe that's a competitive differentiation for us in the market.
Nice.
The second thing I would say is, you know, are we going to fail in execution anywhere? And so, you know, that's probably any CEO would say he's afraid of failing in execution somewhere. And so those two things are the things that I think about the most. You know, where are we at risk on execution, and where are we at risk on culture? So my job becomes, you know, kind of finding those opportunities for improvement, and then, you know, tapping the right people to work on them.
Sure. I guess, yeah, I mean, it all sounds very much in sync, and it's got me thinking back to that phone call that you received, and you were thinking about the mission. I mean, do you mind if I ask, I guess, a bit of a personal question on that?
Sure.
It's just, you know, the way that you've gone about things, and, you know, hearing about what you perhaps keeps you up at night. If you were to now look back at what you thought it might be when you got that call and that buzz of, oh my God, I need to stall on this other offer. This is personally aligned to me, and I can help other families, patients, etc. How do you now feel that you've achieved that, I guess, 3 years on? Have you ever thought about that side of things? It seems like you're very much aligned on getting everything right there, and it, you know, that personal bit, has it, I guess, what's the question I'm looking for is, has it turned out to be what you hoped it would be?
No, it turned out way better than I hoped it would be, which is funny, because, you know, in some ways, look, when you're interviewing someone, you're never going to air all the dirty laundry, right? You want to create a positive thing to bring somebody in. And so, you know, maybe there was a slight disconnect between the organization that I was joining and what I thought during the interview process, because I was somewhat removed. And so when I got into Trialbee, I realized, hey, we got a good amount of work to do here. It was a great platform that was built, but a lot of work to do to get into scale. So you could say, oh, you know, was I let down at all? Absolutely not. The actual ride of Trialbee that I've had over the last 3 years has been amazing. I mean, probably, you know, I loved building NextDocs. I loved working at Microsoft. But I would say the last 3 years have been probably some of the best of my career. Just,
wow.
And I'll tell you why. And I hate to keep hammering on culture. And I hope this whole interview doesn't turn out to be a culture interview. But, you know, I had a mother-in-law, right? My wife's mother.
Mm.
And I used to love talking to this woman. And in the U.S., she was, you know, a diehard Democrat. In the U.S., we have the Democrats and Republicans. Mm. And her husband worked for Chrysler. And so my wife's father-in-law worked for Chrysler, and he worked on the assembly line. He was in the union. Mm. And so my mother-in-law was diehard union. If you don't have a union, nobody's going to take care of the employees. They're going to get beat up by the executives. And so I used to love talking to my mother-in-law. She's just this incredibly smart woman. And we would have these long debates on all kinds of different stuff. But one of the longest debates we would have ongoing was unions wouldn't be necessary if you had the right culture in the company that could sustain itself. And,
gotcha. Yeah.
And so she would say, no, eventually a company gets big, it becomes money driven, and all that goes out the window.
Mm.
And so we used to just have these long debates, and I was always dead set on finding a way to prove to myself that culture could be the winning strategy over everything else, that it trumps everything else.
Mm.
And that it could sustain, and that people would like working where they work, and it wouldn't get financially driven. And, as almost a way to, you know, prove what I used to spout off to my mother. And I was young, and I said a lot of dumb things back then. And so that's what I loved the most about Trialbee, was the opportunity to actually be able to try and do that.
Mm.
Whether we will succeed long-term or not, I think, you know, I don't know. And I'm kind of a take it one day at a time guy, but I know we've done a great job over the last 3 years. I know it's made us a talent magnet. I know that when we open up positions, we get, you know, several hundred applicants that come in.
Wow.
And our team is fanatical about the culture. And if we can maintain that, I believe that I'll win that argument. And unfortunately, my mother-in-law's passed away, but I'll win those arguments we used to have around do you need a union or not.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of my little story about why I've had so much fun at Trialbee. Hmm. Besides the mission of the company, which is quite ambitious and personal to me, is also this piece of being able to really double down on culture as a winning part of the strategy. And I think our customers feel that when they work with us, our employees feel that, our partners feel that. And I think it just creates a nice business model.
Nice. And I guess, yeah, I mean, to an extent, when it gets massive, massive, you know, there's only so much you can do. But it sounds like, you know, there's that phrase, all you can do is all you can do. And it sounds like you're certainly doing that and trying to win that ongoing argument, as you say. And look, with that then, I guess that while we're on the self-reflection side of things, is there anything else that you feel like you've learned about yourself whilst being on this journey, as it may be, whether it's been managing multinational employees, what else has perhaps stood out if you were to look internally at yourself rather than just at the organization?
What have I learned about myself? I'm definitely not as smart as I think I am. I think as I've gotten really smart people into the company, I've learned to listen more and not inject my opinion as much. So I think I've learned or I'm trying to learn to be a better listener, because I, you know, there's nothing great than having somebody who's just excels at their craft. I mean, like, you know, this podcast you're doing is quite well known, right? I don't know if you know that, James, or not, but it's quite well known.
I mean,
it's
got a good following. Stats here and there, but I'm always a little bit miffed by it. I try to just do what I do.
But you're just good at the craft, you know, and you have this thing going. And I think that, you know, when you get people in the company who are good at their craft, you're best just to let them continue being good at their craft. And there's always maybe something I can add. But generally, I should listen more than I talk. So I think I've learned that, you know, when problems arise, as opposed to try and solve them myself, I'm not this infinite guy who's as smart as he thinks sometimes. It's just better to get somebody who's amazing at that craft who can come in and solve that problem. So I would say that's definitely one thing. And that's been humbling for me. And I think it's made me a better leader by being humbled a little bit. The other thing I've learned is that by being a vulnerable leader, you create a better organization. I'm trying to think of a better word than better. You know, by being vulnerable myself and saying things like I just said, right? That allows people, I think, to feel like it's okay to make mistakes.
Mm.
And then there's not this fear of perfection. And I think people in that environment can innovate better. They can come up with better ideas. They can help make the whole company better through their ideas.
Mm.
And so I think I've learned the importance of being vulnerable as a leader, which is maybe something I didn't appreciate coming in.
Yeah, no, I have to agree with that. I guess, yeah, anytime that I speak to a lot of execs and senior level folk these days, and, you know, often the bigger the organization, the more I'm kind of like, oh my God, they're a huge player in this industry. I'm just like, oh my God, they're just like such a nice, normal guy is normally the term that I say to the missus when I come off calls. And, you know, I think that actually goes a long way. So, no, fair play on that. And I guess, look, coming back to Trial B now, what are the plans moving forward? It sounds like it's been a bit of a roller coaster joining at the height of COVID where we were all working remotely. I'm guessing that is an office that you are in at the moment with the glazed glass at the back there. But what's on the cards next in terms of innovation, clients, problems that you're going to solve, et cetera?
Yeah, really good question. I think, you know, for the next 2 years, it's probably not adding, it's resisting the temptation to add new things and just continue to do what we do very well.
Mm-hmm.
This was a conversation. Our leadership team gets together we're quite remote too.
Yeah.
We get together in person once a quarter. And this was the theme of our last quarterly meeting was, hey, let's not do anything new for a long time. Let's just iterate and iterate and iterate on what we do and scale that really, yeah, really well, because that ultimately helps solve the problem we're trying to solve. So building on the platform and its capabilities and keeping it focused on solving recruitment and enrollment, our delivery capabilities, continuing to do more work for our clients where they want someone else to do the work around, you know, global recruitment and translations and IRB approvals, materials, all these things, doing more full service work. And on the partnership side, just having a good engine for bringing partners in and having them work on our studies alongside us. And so,
yeah,
I think it's just iterating on what we already do as opposed to trying to do new things. I think the natural inclination is to go do something new. But I think we become a more sustainable organization long-term if we just continue to focus on our core offering.
I think so. I mean, that's often the sensible thing to do. Sometimes hard to do though, isn't it? When things are going well, it's like, it can be very easy to get carried away with things, I find.
I agree entirely. In fact, when I joined Trial B, we were doing several things. Recruitment was one of them. We had an e-consent product. We had a patient engagement app for retention. And so there was all these, you know, multiple things going on in the company, which was great. And all of them were good on their own. But we made a decision that, hey, we're a small organization. Let's just focus down and do one thing extremely, extremely well. And that turned out to be a good decision.
I don't know whether it's business. I just think in life in general, the more you end up specializing and just doing like, kind of like almost being a one-trick pony. When I worked at a large recruitment business before starting Huxley Morton, you know, a lot of the team used to almost laugh at me. They were like, James, what do you recruit? And I was recruiting like expat engineers around the world, but it was just like one job title. That's all I did. And they used to laugh at me. But then, you know, kind of years on when I was like outperforming them by a mile, yep. Like, how do you do that? Just doing one thing? Also, because I just do one thing. That's it.
You can go very, very deep.
Yeah.
And you can actually solve the problem better than anybody else. That's what I believe. Yeah.
So, no, I respect that. Well, look, Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. As I said, I was probably way too ignorant about Trial B before, you know, speaking to yourself. Didn't know exactly what it is, but Didn't know that the company had a headquarters in Sweden. But no, it's been a very good overview from yourself. And yeah, didn't necessarily expect you to touch on culture so much, but being a recruiter, I love that subject anyway. And so you've certainly filled that gap for me. So we'll keep tabs on how things are going. It doesn't sound like you need any support in terms of being a talent magnet to get people on board. But for those of you who are watching, you've kind of heard it from the horse's mouth here. You know, probably best to go and take a look at the website and see any vacancies that do come up. It sounds like a great place to work. But before I let you go, Matt, have a bit of a quick fire question round that we always close the show with. And I guess to kick that off, I always take people back to the beginning and ask, if you were to give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
One piece of advice to my younger self, listen more. Probably be the best advice I could give myself when I was younger. Yeah.
Fair enough. I think we could all take that advice when we were younger.
My mom always had a saying when I was growing up, slow to speak and quick to listen. So practicing what my mom told me, probably.
Awesome. Go on. The next one, obviously, podcasts are big these days, but if you were to list, I guess, the number one book, resource, website that you either enjoy or would want to direct our audience to, what would it be?
Oh, to pick one is really hard. I would say the things that I'm into right now, and this changed year to year, but I think from a leadership perspective, there's a book, Traction, that has a framework that we've been using to manage the organization at Trowbee, called the EOS framework. And so if you're a leader, Traction, I think. If you're working to inspire other people or teams, I think Mindset is a good book. Mindset's by Carol Dweck. It's a really good book on having a growth mindset. Mm-hmm. If you're in product, I think a classic is Marty Kagan's Inspired. Marketing, there's a book called Story Brand, How to Tell Story Brand or something. It's a great book. We use that a lot.
I've come across that one.
If you're in sales, The Expansion Sales, good book. So I think it depends on your discipline. There's no one trick, but those are
like
ones.
It's like speaking to a library here, Matt. I mean, they say leaders are readers, but you've clearly got that nailed. And obviously earlier you mentioned the first 90 days, was it?
First 90 days, if you're taking a new role in your existing company or joining another company, I highly recommend anybody I hire onto my team reads that coming in.
Awesome. And look, you mentioned earlier about kind of your one-to-ones that you have throughout the business to get to know each other and mix things up. And the topic is effectively not work. So when you're on a call with people, you know, what's typically your topic? What's your favorite thing outside of work? Because we all have lives outside of work, which is amazing. what's your favorite thing outside of work?
Well, like most dads, my kids, I think, is probably about all I have time for. They take up the majority of my time, although mine are getting older. So I was just telling my kids the other day, dad needs to find a hobby because they're all starting to grow up and get out of the house. But, you know, I think being a dad is a tough gig. And I would say my hobby outside of work has always been my kids.
Awesome. Yeah, you're going to need a hobby that takes a lot of time because they do take a lot of time.
Yeah.
Dad of a couple of youngsters myself, I know that for sure. And look, finally, and to close the show, you know, if you had one rule for both life and business to summarize it all up, a little bit deep, but what would that one rule be?
Oh, man. I mean, I'm a big believer in trying to be the best version of myself that I can. And I think that has had an impact in my personal life and in my professional life. And I'm far from achieving that best. But if I could be the best version of myself today with all my limitations and defects and everything else, I think that's a good day. And so I think that's probably a big mantra of mine. Just be the best version of myself I can be.
Awesome stuff. Well, look, Matt, once again, I just want to say thanks for jumping on the show, sharing your story. It's been an absolute pleasure. For anyone looking to reach out or learn more about Trowbee, what's the best links, emails, websites, etc. to catch you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on LinkedIn quite a bit, so happy to connect on LinkedIn. And my email is you know, first.lastname at trialme.com. So Matt.Walls, WALZ. Those are probably the best two ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome stuff. Well, look, thanks again for being part of the show.
Thanks for having me, James.
I will, certainly keep in contact myself.